From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nam. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Justin Wilson, the mayor of Alexandria, Virginia. Joining us now in studio is Brianne Nadeau. She's a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 1. Brianne Nadeau is a Democrat. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Tom Sherwood, the state legislature in Virginia was not able to repeal a law that bans expectorating in the states, as in spitting. You're not allowed to spit in public in the Commonwealth of Virginia. It was able to get rid of laws banning cursing and other similar violations, but for some reason or the other, it couldn't repeal the law banning spitting. And Senator Joe Morrison, a man who knows just a little bit about behavior that's frowned upon, said that he is opposed to it because he considers it yucky.
Well, I think we can all agree that, I think most people would agree that spitting is yucky. But it also, though, is a health hazard. You know, it can be a funny topic and it can be a serious topic. But, you know, the idea of getting rid of old laws like no fornicating and
swearing in public.
I mean, fortunately, police don't arrest us for swearing in public. The jails could not be big enough.
We'd be arresting all of the politicians.
This is kind of the funny.
Except Brianne, right.
This is kind of the funny side of what Virginia is doing, though, because you remember Governor Northam put together a commission to go through the state laws on racial inequities, right. And they came up with 100 or so laws that needed to be changed, even if they're not enforced, and that's still before the legislature in various pieces. So there are lots of old laws, you know, that could be done away with.
What's the law in the District of Columbia regarding expectorating? Brianne Nadeau, can you spit in public here?
I really don't know, but I don't even know how you enforce a law like that.
Can you curse in public in the District of Columbia?
I mean, I hope so, because if not, I break the law a lot.
Can you fornicate in the District of Columbia?
That, I believe, falls under indecent exposure.
Okay.
But, you know, my concern with all these laws is they're not evenly enforced. And then you get back to that issue of what's, you know, racist law enforcement, so.
Right, targeted enforcement.
Yeah.
Maryland.
But we agree not to spit on this program.
It is icky, yucky.
Maryland yucky. Governor Larry Hogan, he who refuses to appear on this broadcast, has condemned or is severely critical of Democrats in the state legislature in Virginia because they have decided that, well, not have decided, House Majority Leader Eric Luedtke sponsored a bill to expand sales taxes, and the purpose of that would be to fund the Kerwin Commission recommendations, which is going to cost the state some $4 billion. He says that's the best way to do it, and by expanding, it means that they won't only be taxing goods, they'll be taxing services.
Well, you might say that the governor is spitting mad.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, I know, it's terrible. But, you know, the legislature had said, the leaders of the legislature said that they would not just go out and raise taxes to fund the Kerwin reports, about $2.6 billion in more revenue needed. And so they've looked for ways to tax things that have not been taxed. And a year ago, the state was pointing out, like many jurisdictions, that many services are not taxed. And so the plan from Mr. Luedtke and other the leaders is to tax things that haven't been taxed, because a great many things, as he told me, why would you tax books but not bookkeeping? And so services can be taxed, and it can raise money to pay for education across the board. Some things, nonprofits and other things, would not be taxed. But this is a new way to raise funds, because so you just don't tax things, you tax services.
Brianne Nadeau, what do you think about that?
I, for one,
was somewhat surprised that services are not taxed.
Yeah. No, but this was the big yoga tax.
Yeah,
don't let my barber
tax,
hear about
remember,
this. Back
right?
in 2014,
gyms
the yoga tax.
And carpet cleaning, right. And certain services. And when we had the Tax Revision Commission, they recommended that we just create some parity among all the different things that we're taxing. So we did.
Yes. So internet internet sales and other kinds of things.
That was a huge windfall for us.
And that is a windfall.
The internet sales tax we were able to put towards, I believe, human
services. So as much as the governor's mad, I even contacted his staff, said this would be a great subject for him or someone from his staff to come on the show and talk about it. And as you know, Governor Hogan has not yet come on the show, as you've always welcomed him. But this is a changing the way business works, and this is what the legislature is doing. And the governor says it's going to be the biggest tax increase in Maryland history. We'll see.
Well, the lieutenant governor has been on the show. Boyd Rutherford has been on the show.
I'm just wondering if that's why the governor won't come on. Maybe he got a bad. Maybe we got a bad.
I'll call Boyd and have him ask the governor to come on the show. At the same time, however, the watchdog group Public Citizen would like has filed an ethics complaint against Governor Hogan. It says that Governor Hogan was involved in a measure that would also profit the business that he's running. Please explain.
Well, the short answer is Public Citizen, which is a consumer organization, filed a complaint saying the governor has allowed road projects and other developmental issues to occur in and around areas where he owns property and where he personally benefits. I think, and again, I could say to wear this subject out, the governor was spitting mad at this suggestion. He says he's followed, I won't say it again, I promise, he's followed all the laws, all the disclosure. His brother runs the company, and he has not violated any ethics, and he's not sure why this is even being filed. Public Citizen says there's a lot of development going on, and the governor's wealth has increased while he's been in office, and now it's before the State Ethics Commission, and they'll have to do some fact-finding and review and see where this complaint goes.
Okay, on to what's happening in the District of Columbia. Our guest is Brianne Nadeau. She's a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 1. If you have questions or comments for her, give us a call, 800-433-8850. I'd intended to start on another subject, but calls are already pouring in on this one, so people seem to be spitting mad. Let's start with that. Let's talk sweet drinks. Right now, if you buy a soda...
Very upset about that.
If you buy a soda or sugary drink in D.C., you'll be charged an 8% tax. And just for reference, the usual sales tax in D.C. is 6%. You'd like to replace that with an excise tax on the distributors of these drinks to the tune of 1.5 cents per ounce. Mm-hmm. Why are you pushing for this change?
So this legislation came out from a grassroots movement of organizers who care about public health, and they're seeing the way that sugary drinks are being marketed to specifically youth of color east of the river. If you look at marketing and advertising budgets from these companies, it is really offensive the way they're targeting the populations there. And we see increased rates of illness related to consumption of sugar there. And so folks came to me and said, we need to do something. And the taxes that we have in place, the sales taxes, they don't change the way people think about their purchases. So we'd be repealing those, and we'd be replacing them with an excise tax. And the revenue from that would go to all kinds of health programs to help people.
Go ahead. We have a caller on the side.
Here's Andrew in Washington, D.C. on that issue. Andrew, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, and thank you, Councilman Renato. So I am the owner of the only local soda company in D.C. Quite frankly, this tax would be the end of my company. I definitely support robust public health programs and definitely support, improved education around what people are putting into their bodies. But as we have seen, these types of taxes just don't actually do and change behavior, and they seem to be targeted at specific populations. I know personally for my product, which is an all-natural ingredient beverage, I go out of my way to use better products, and this tax would basically put me out of business. And
why would it put you out of business?
Because the margins of running a business are so thin that a 20 cents increase on the distributor on a product that sold for around $2 is pretty detrimental. That could be the money that I would use to hire someone.
Mm-hmm. Or and is your product only sweetened, or do you have the unsweetened and diet versions too?
I don't have an unsweetened diet version. I don't mm-hmm. actually have a plan to have unsweetened diet versions. Mm-hmm. It's just not what my products are about. Mm-hmm. And I think that my products are very conscious in terms of what they're using and like where we're sourcing. But I think the larger point is that it's just like another tax on specific populations in the city that can least afford it. And while incredibly well,
well, when you say it's a tax on specific populations in the city, you seem to be addressing the same populations that Councilmember Brianne Nadeau feels are in need of less sugar. So what are you saying here?
So why is taxing them going to be the answer to that and not...
I'll have Councilmember Nadeau answer, respond.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, the idea behind an excise tax is, frankly, what you're concerned about, which is that people will consume less of something. People have said to me that it seems to them like a regressive tax because it's, you know, a tax on a good. But the goal is for people to make a different choice, right? Nobody has to buy a sugary beverage. They could very well buy a low-sugar juice or a diet beverage. You know, that doesn't help this caller, I realize.
Why do you single out sugary beverages when I go to my grocery store and any store around the city, and there are sugar-laden cookies, mm-hmm. and in the front of most stores there are cakes and all kinds of heavily sugared products that lower-income people do buy, in fact, because they're often cheap and they're to get people into the store, the first thing you might see when you come into a store. It seems to be fairly narrowly targeted just to soda pop. Why just soda?
There's a couple of reasons. One, it's not just soda. It's any sugary beverage. So why just beverages?
And because I know of the way, a huge part of
yeah, it's purchase. Because of the way people consume them, right? I mean, people consume more liquid than they do cookies, et cetera, and especially when people have it with every meal or they have it without really thinking about it. The idea behind an excise tax is to get people thinking about what they're consuming before they buy it, as opposed to a sales tax.
What about a bottle tax, bottle and can tax?
I feel like that's a sort of different conversation. I mean, I'm always open, but that's not what we're trying to do with this.
D.C. Department of Transportation just announced new protected bus and bike lanes coming to 14th Street in Columbia Heights, along with a few other changes. Well, we can move on to another question. I know your opinion about that already. I was going to ask you, what do you think this will mean for residents and commuters in your ward?
So we were thrilled to get the express bus there a couple years ago. We all worked really hard, Council, ANC.
Where precisely?
This is down 14th Street, which is really, in my mind, one of the lifebloods of the city and Ward 1 in particular. And I was living on 14th for a long time, and taking those 50 buses, they're always overcrowded. You have to wait for one or two or three, and they're never on time. And it's because of the bottleneck in Columbia Heights. So even when we added the express bus, that did not eliminate the bottleneck. So these dedicated lanes for bikes and buses, it's going to have a huge impact on the reliability of the system.
There's a difference between a dedicated lane and a protected lane.
Mm-hmm.
Is the bike lane going to be protected?
Actually, so it's all one lane, and parts of it are going to be protected for both, so that you don't have cars moving in and out of them.
Because on 7th Street and other places where we have these painted lanes mm-hmm. for buses, I've sat in, not in those lanes, but I've sat nearby, and I have watched them routinely get filled up with cars.
Yep.
Everyone wants to stop just for a moment to deliver something or stop just for a moment to pick up someone or to let someone off. And so those moments add up to hours of a time when these lanes are not free.
Yeah, DPW is doing more enforcement on all of that, which folks really need to watch out for because those tickets are hefty.
Before we go to break, speaking of safe cycling, last November you wrote an emergency bill that would impel DDOT to start the protected bikeway project on 9th Street Northwest. You postponed that bill mm-hmm. after receiving wavering support from colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
What's next for their concerns, and what's next for this project, and what were some of their concerns? It's my understanding that their concerns had to do with objections coming from, quote-unquote, the community.
So... this is the Eastern Downtown Cycle Track, protected bike lanes, Tom. Mm-hmm. This this has been in the works. This has been planned for 5 years. DDOT had identified 9th Street as the priority corridor, would have the least impact on neighboring churches and parking, et cetera, and would also have the most impact for cyclists. In the 5 years that we've been waiting for this project to be implemented, there have been 5,000 crashes. So I felt, because DDOT had just stalled this project for so long, emergency legislation really move it forward. We are going to present it to the council March 3rd as emergency legislation, which means we need 8 votes. So now we're working to get those 8 votes. And
what's the objection you're hearing?
To be honest, there's a couple churches in the corridor that are concerned. And one of the things that we've done, because a lot there's a lot of dynamics between long-time institutions and new infrastructure.
And part of this is, I was looking at Ward 1. You're in, for people who don't know, I think you may be the geographically smallest ward in the city.
You're
in the heart of the district.
Yeah.
And it's been had a significant change due to gentrification, racial makeup of that ward. I just looked at it this morning. Mm-hmm. It's now 58% white. Mm-hmm. Just in 10 years ago, it was 46%. African Americans now make about like 22%. Is this fight over mostly African American churches who don't want bike lanes to take up spaces where their parishioners park, and other issues? Is this part of the changing nature of the District of Columbia and gentrification?
I think that's at the heart of it. And despite the fact that my legislation guarantees that no Sunday parking would be removed as part of this, there are other dynamics there. One of the things that's a really dangerous trap to fall into, however, is to equate bike lanes and cycle tracks with gentrification. I mean, the truth is we've always needed this infrastructure. Changing neighborhoods have given us the revenue that allow us to do it, but it's not just white people who bike.
Got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with DC Councilmember Brianna Doe. If you'd like to call her, well, the lines are all filled up, so you might want to send us a tweet at Kojo Show or email to kojo@wamu.org. Kelly tweeted, didn't taxes on cigarettes in New York City reduce smoking and purchase of cigarettes? Why wouldn't this work on taxes and soda? I'm Kojo Namdi.
This month at WAMU, we're lifting our voices to shine a light on Black changemakers throughout American history. Some you know and some you don't, but they all change the world. Go to wamu.org/lifteveryvoice to learn the stories of these incredible African American changemakers and to hear special interviews spotlighting those who have impacted the arts, sciences, sports, and activism. Go to wamu.org/lifteveryvoice.
Welcome back. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Alexandria Mayor Justin Wilson. Joining us in studio now is Brianna Doe. She's a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 1. Of course, Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. Tom.
A political question. Mayor Bowser has been traveling the country. She's been to Michigan, Texas, and even South Virginia, campaigning for Michael Bloomberg. She's one of his national co-chairs. He may have 100 of them, not sure how many. But I'm just wondering, are you getting involved in the Democratic presidential race?
Yeah.
Did you see the debate the other night? That was quite the food fight.
Oh.
And where are you very quickly on who are you supporting, if anyone?
Well, before it was cool, a couple weeks ago, I endorsed Elizabeth Warren. And I need to go back and watch the tape from this week.
So it's cool now?
Well, after this debate this week,
she came out fighting. You know,
yeah.
She was fading from view, and she said, I'm going to go back the way I was
I've been a huge fan of hers since she was at CFPB.
Okay, you and Alyssa Silverman, I think, said the same thing on the show.
I think she walks the walk.
Okay, now, what about are you active in the District Democratic State Committee?
I am not.
So you're not trying to be a delegate to the Democratic Convention or?
I had the privilege of doing it at Philly, and it was a great opportunity, but I want someone else to be able to have that opportunity.
And one more political question. You signed, along with everyone else on the council, the letter asking discouraging Jack Evans from running for the Ward 2 seat again.
Yeah.
He is, in fact, running again.
Yep.
I'm moderating a debate in early March where I think he will attend along with all the other candidates. Are you getting involved in that race? Are you supporting anyone in that race?
I haven't supported anyone thus far. I'm keeping a close watch on it. I'm hoping somebody releases some poll data, because I think what we need to do is get a candidate to surge out and get some consolidation in that field, because what we can't have is Jack Evans back in the Wilson building.
And if he were to be reelected, if he got either the special election and got back on the council,
I would move so fast to unseat him again that you would have whiplash.
And what would that be? Do you mean to?
We would have to do a resolution. We would have to finish the removal effort because, I mean, and
you would you want to schedule another to expel him or
yes.
just deny him committees or what?
No, we'd have to expel him. I mean, it is egregious. And
what
would
you say to the voters of Ward 2 who elected him?
Well, I hope they won't. But
what
prepared.
Would you say to the ones who do? I mean, Alyssa Silverman won her large seat, I think, with 11% of the vote.
Silverman doesn't have an ethics problem.
What I'm suggesting is, and then Phil Mendelson won his seat, I think, with 17 or 19% of the vote when he first got elected.
Mm-hmm.
If the people elect you, doesn't that have something to say about whether you should be on there, unless you find new violations of that Jack Evans has done?
I mean, it doesn't say enough to me.
You introduced a bill that would require D.C. government buildings and businesses to have diaper-changing tables available for all genders, so that means in men's rooms as well.
That's right.
This will largely affect restaurants and bars. What led you to introduce this bill?
Parents. Being a parent and knowing parents who like to take their kids out for dinner, for, you know, evening events, and the men don't have anywhere to change the babies. Sometimes the women don't either, and that means that the burden is on the women. And if you're a same-sex couple with no woman, then you got to change the baby wherever you can find a space.
I suspect that's going to get a lot of support on the council. But at a hearing last month, two advocates of the nightlife mm-hmm. and restaurant industry asked that age-restricted bars or clubs be exempted from this requirement. So if a club already bans people under 18 or 21 from entering, they wouldn't have to include changing tables. What's
yeah.
your take on that?
Well, I'm open to the discussion, but I just have to point out, as I did in the hearing, that a lot of these establishments now have family events. If you look at, say, the Black Cat in Ward 1, which is a nightclub, they have a monthly children's event called the Rumpus Room, where they've got kids running all over the club. So I do think that they're sort of a, you got to pick a side there, right? We want them to be family friendly. And it's not actually an incredibly large burden. I mean, it's a couple $100s to buy a piece of equipment like this.
Well, Scott in Ward 1 wants to know why. Well, Scott, you speak for yourself. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I appreciate the interest in changing tables for folks, but I guess I'm remiss if I didn't say, what about the crime uptick in Ward 1, the shootings? I know that you've held some safety
meetings. Why are you running around passing legislation, introducing legislation on diapers when crime is such a serious issue in Ward 1?
Well, as a parent, I know how to do more than one thing at a time. We work on critical issues simultaneously all the time on the council. So introducing legislation while also working to address public safety is part of my job. And this is a much longer conversation that I'm always happy to engage with my constituents on. But we've doubled the amount of resources in the ward to address public safety since the summer.
Resources meaning more officers?
There was a surge in officers, and then we also have double the resources for all of the auxiliary services that are helping us prevent and reduce crime. So,
For example?
Violence interruption, moving people out of their life of violence into different programs. And the police have always been there. The police have always been well-resourced. But the police they need help. And so we're trying to give them all the support they can.
Here now is Daniel in Shepherd Park. Daniel, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi, thank you. Hi, Councilwoman. Quick question. I'm a little confused about this is a question about the proposed soda tax. It's my understanding that although your intention is to use the proceeds from the tax to fund health programs for low-income and minority areas, the tax is only being levied, or would only be levied if passed, against people in those neighborhoods, not in higher-income, Starbucks, high-end stores or outlets that sell equally, if not more, sugary beverages. So if the intent is to help people in low-income minority areas, why are they the only ones being taxed?
That is incorrect. It's a universal tax everywhere in the city for all sugary beverages.
I've been looking ever since I saw that this was an issue that was coming up. I've researched it and looked at the proposed legislation, and that does not seem to be the case.
When you say that does not seem to be the case, Daniel, she just said that the legislation applies to every single ward in the city. What evidence do you have that it doesn't?
Kojo, I'm not saying that it's restricted.
How would you tax Starbucks?
Against products. So, for example, if you or I were to go to Starbucks, the tax that the councilwoman is proposing to pass would not be levied against people who go to high-end coffee places like Starbucks where sugary drinks are sold. It's not a question of...
Well, just ask that. Is that true? If I go to Starbucks and I buy one of their sugary drinks, is it taxed?
Yeah, it's taxed at the distributor level. So when Starbucks is purchasing their orange juice or, you know, all the other canned beverages they have, those are taxed too, and that's passed on to the consumer most typically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much for your call, Daniel. You introduced legislation that would require DCHA, the DC Housing Authority, to give the council 45 days notice before submitting a demolition application to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Why? What problem is DCHA facing that this bill would help to solve?
Oh, well, the Housing Authority right now is moving forward with its repositioning plan, which means it's going to be dispersing essentially 4,000 residents without real plans for their placement. And so my legislation would require them, before they apply for a demolition disposition of any property, 45-day review period for the council, and they'd have to provide us information about the right to return. So folks would have to have the right to return. They'd have to have a relocation plan. They'd have to demonstrate the feasibility of building first rather than dispersing people while they build, and a one-for-one replacement plan to ensure that the units are built back. Folks can come back to the same size unit that they were in. These are common sense things that you
Isn't that part of the law now that they would have to do these things?
No.
They just have full authority just to throw people out and tear down buildings?
Yes.
Is it an independent authority?
Yes. I also have legislation that would bring them into the rest of the government so they wouldn't be independent anymore.
And I'm afraid that's about all the time we have. Brianne Nadeau is a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 1. She is a Democrat. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, both of you.
Up next, Justin Wilson, the mayor of Alexandria. If you have questions or comments for him, start calling now, 800-433-8850. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Welcome back. Joining us in studio now is Justin Wilson. He is the mayor of Alexandria, Virginia. He's a Democrat. Mayor Wilson, thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be back.
Before we get specifically to Alexandria, Tom Sherwood, the General Assembly in Virginia, now dominated by Democrats, and Governor Ralph Northam had as one of his priorities the banning of assault weapons in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Four Democrats voted alongside with Republicans opposing that ban, and so it has not come into effect. What happened here?
Well, it was a committee vote, and I think four Democrats did join with the minority Republicans. There was some confusion and political unease about the assault weapons ban, about exactly defining the assault weapons ban and how it would work. Mark Levine from Alexandria, I believe, was the sponsor of this bill. He said there's just no reason to have assault weapons, almost how you define them in any way, on the streets of Virginia. But the Assembly has passed several gun control measures that had been long stopped in the legislature with the Republicans. So it is a setback for the governor, but it's only part of his plan, and most of it's passing.
Well, you mentioned Mark Levine, who sponsored this bill. He happens to live in the city of Alexandria, and I'd like to start.
As we all know.
He's my delegate. A gun protest
that happened. The chair of the Hopewell, Virginia Republican Party, a Brandon Howard, protested outside of Delegate Mark Levine's house in Old Town on Saturday with a large gun, a Virginia flag, and a sign that said, "Withdraw HB 961. That's the bill that Levine sponsored that would ban assault weapons. Bill, of course, wasn't passed. Levine called the police for his protection. What did you make of this incident?
Well, it was beyond just a protest. Obviously, we support freedom of speech and peaceful protest. In this case, you had an armed gentleman who published a video which made threats against Delegate Levine and his family. That has no place in our community, no place in the Commonwealth, and no place in our country. And so, reprehensible behavior.
Yeah, I looked at the Facebook posting by this by Mr. Howard from Hopewell, Virginia, who said, "You, sir, are a traitor to this nation. You, sir, are a tyrant." And it went on from there. It sounded threatening. Mr. Delegate Levine has asked the, I guess, state police or your Alexander police.
He's asked the Alexander police and the Alexander Commonwealth's attorney, and they're certainly looking into it. So
still looking into possibly, because it is a threatening, whatever the Facebook is threatening, that he stood there fairly quietly outside the home, didn't do anything, but he did have two assault weapons with him, not just one.
Yeah, I'll obviously leave it to the law enforcement to determine whether it was a violation of law. In my view, it's reprehensible behavior. It shouldn't have a place in the public discourse.
Virginia Governor Ralph Northam recently launched a local government exchange program. Alexander is a part of it. You're paired with Norton, Virginia. Tell us about that program. What do you hope to learn from Norton? What do you hope Norton learns from you?
Yeah, well, we're very excited to be. Southwest Virginia. We are very excited to be the pilot of this new program. I think this is an initiative of the governor, very akin to sister cities that we currently have a number of sister cities in Alexandria around the world. And this is promoting sister city relationships within the Commonwealth. And, we had a kickoff a couple weeks ago down at the governor's mansion, and we're able to meet the counterparts from Norton and Wise County. And, I think we found that there are a lot of things we had in common. There are certainly things that were very, very different. We look forward to going down there, and we look forward to hosting them up here and learning what we can about the common issues that we work through.
And you were in Wise County?
Not yet. I have been in the past.
I'm not sure they have good internet reception down there, broadband reception, so be careful.
Well, yeah, let's talk about the roads there and in Alexandria, because both Alexandria and Norton are looking into road diets as traffic solutions in the city. Can you explain what road diets are and how Alexandria is using them to reduce traffic accidents?
So it was actually one of the surprises in my conversation with the mayor from Norton. It is a technique used all around the world to slow traffic and improve pedestrian safety. We have a couple situations in the past several years where we've deployed road diets where you're basically narrowing lanes and narrowing.
Seminary
is the one that's most recent and certainly controversial. And apparently the folks in Norton are looking at such a thing in their downtown. So I had a conversation with Mayor Fawbush, who's the mayor of Norton, about that when we were down at the governor's mansion. So
what's not
an issue I expected that we would have in common. So
what's the basic political fight? Is it you want to – these roadways, people will tell you if you go in Seminary or Duke or any of these major roadways, Washington, that they are trying to get home, they're trying to get to work, they're trying to go shop, and the traffic is already, they say, bad enough. And now if you narrow it for bus lanes and bike lanes and slower speed limits and time lights to make you stop as opposed to go, that it changes the whole culture of driving. Is that what you're doing?
The Seminary Road opponents have even started a Facebook page, which I went to this morning, to oppose the road diet on Seminary Road. They're saying that four lanes of traffic have been reduced to two. They're worried about emergency vehicles being able to travel quickly and safely along the road.
Sure. Yeah, obviously change is always a challenge. And in local government, we're constantly doing balancing interests. In the case of Seminary, you had a 0.9-mile section of road that was four lanes and was fed in either direction by a single lane. So two lanes being fed by one lane in either direction. Whenever we repave a road, in order to be more efficient with the taxpayer dollars, we look at that road section, we solicit the community, we try to understand what safety issues there are, what other modes we want to accommodate. In the case of Seminary, we were missing a sidewalk on one side of the road, and so I think we reduced the lanes down from 4 to 3. We actually have a center lane, added a number of pedestrian crossings, and added a shared sidewalk bike space on the other side that ultimately will be converted into a full-out sidewalk. And again, just trying to balance and making sure that we accommodate pedestrians and bikes. And
there are a couple of people who would like to comment on that. We got a tweet from Doug who says, why does Mayor Wilson insist on spending $1.5 million on an unnecessary project on a 0.9-mile stretch of an arterial roadway when the city of Alexandria schools are crumbling? Gas leaks, lead in the water, sure, and more are rampant in the public schools. We'll talk about that, the public schools, in a minute. But
sure,
also on the road diet, here's Amy in Alexandria, Virginia. Amy, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo. I really appreciate you taking my call. And connected with the issue of the road diet, I think there's a larger issue. I want to discuss the road diet. But in Alexandria, we have the at-large city council. So our neighborhoods don't actually have a direct voice from my neighborhood to the city council. We're subject to some at-large councilmen and the mayor who are not, unfortunately, are not listening to the voices of the people that live on and around Seminary Road. Now, I've been a 15-year resident of Alexandria. It's a 0.9-mile stretch that goes from nowhere to wherever, unless you're in a car and you want to get from 395 to downtown or to your house. We rarely see bicyclists on this stretch, and it's actually not a contiguous center lane. It's stopped by ballards and medians, so emergency vehicles, if traffic's backed up east or west, cannot necessarily use that center lane safely to go around traffic. That is also the street that leads to our only city hospital and a major fire station. So this was a fool, a waste of money, and I'm afraid that the city's going in the same direction when they're talking about co-locating city services and affordable housing on our school campus.
Allow me to have the mayor respond.
Yeah. So, first of all, as far as public safety is concerned, because obviously the core responsibility of government is protecting public safety, the fire chief and the fire staff were involved in the development of this design on the street. He has assured us repeatedly that it has no impact on emergency response, and they are able to use the road safely to traverse and provide emergency response. If the fire chief ever said to me that that was not the case and they could no longer use the road for emergency response, I would be the first one standing in line saying we have to undo what we've done there. But in the end, we said from the beginning that we will evaluate how this goes once it's had a chance to settle. We'll look at the traffic pattern. We'll look at what it does to congestion. Right now, for about 160 of 163 hours a week, traffic congestion is better or the same as it was before. During the peak period in the morning, the peak period in the afternoon, usually between Tuesday and Thursday, there are some slightly longer congestion, about up to a minute. And if that, we'll certainly evaluate that at the conclusion of this pilot, and we'll see where we're at.
The caller just now mentioned something in passing about building affordable homes on school properties. I was talking to Julie Carey from NBC4 yep. about the gun protests and the roads, and she also mentioned that there's some either misinformation or some concerns being expressed that at MacArthur and George Mason Elementaries that some of the property developers were secretly planning, I don't know how you can secretly plan anything these days, but secretly planning to build some kind of affordable housing on these properties. Yeah. Can you succinctly clarify all that?
Yeah, so about $1 billion of the $2 billion proposed capital improvement program is municipal facilities. It's schools and city facilities. A couple years ago, we put together a task force, and one of their recommendations was that we explore municipal facility co-location wherever possible. So whenever we're doing a municipal building on a city property or school property, we look to accommodate as many municipal needs as possible. Yeah. And we try to accommodate complementary needs. We put affordable housing with a fire station a number of years ago. We put rec centers with schools. We look at different health services with schools. And so that's been our approach in the past, and I think that'll be our approach in the future, trying to find complementary uses.
What specifically about MacArthur and George George Mason. Yeah, so is there or is there not a plan to put affordable housing on those properties?
So at MacArthur, there was exploration that was later aborted to see if they could include some workforce housing for teachers as part of that design that ultimately was abandoned because of the time schedule. And at George Mason, there's no proposal right now.
Mark, a quick issue about transportation. The Potomac Yard South Station, there was a hope that the Metro would build a South Station that had been secretly killed. But then there's a plan for a pedestrian bridgeway to get there. But I'm told now that the pedestrian bridge walkway is in jeopardy, may not be built.
Indeed, we got an email from George who said, what's the latest on the south entrance to the Potomac Yard Metro stop? Virginia has offered a boatload of money, but not enough.
Yeah. So the original design for the station was a mezzanine in the north and a mezzanine in the south that had entrances. So basically four entrances, one in each corner. As part of the bidding process in order dealing with higher construction costs, we abandoned the southern mezzanine, and there's still planned a northern mezzanine, so there'll be a northeast entrance, northwest entrance. The Commonwealth provided $50 million as part of the Amazon incentive effort to the city in order to improve access to the southwest. And we're still working with WMATA right now and the contractor that WMATA chose to build the station in order to see what that can accommodate. The design that came out of the community for that southwest access exceeded the $50 million. And so we're trying to figure out what we can build with that $50 million or whether we need to go into a separate phase and do it later.
Oh, but it will be done?
We will use that money to enhance access to the station from the southwest. That's the goal.
Can I
need to see what we can afford.
I want to get to budget for a second.
Can I have one hot question?
Sure.
The Appomattox, Appy is sometimes called, the statue in the middle of Alexandria.
Yep.
Another change among the Democrats in the legislature is they are moving to allow local governments to decide to move statuary of all types. Appomattox, I think, has been there. The statue of the lone Confederate soldier looking south has been there 130 years. It's been
rebuilt once. The statue honors Alexandrians who died while fighting for the Confederacy.
Right, that's where they staged the walk south after the defeat. The idea is to move it over to the Lyceum, which is your museum across the street there. Is that going to happen, or what do you think?
Well, so about 3.5 years ago, the council had voted unanimously to pursue moving the statue out of the middle of Washington Street. There is a state statute today that specifically protects that statue. And at the moment, there is legislation, as you said, that looks to be going to the governor that would give us the authority to move it. It's actually owned by the Daughters of the Confederacy, but it's protected by that state statute. So if the governor signs legislation that provides the city with that authority, I imagine we will carry out city policy, which is to move it out of the middle.
I think the initial plan was to move it to the Lyceum, would that be up to
The Daughters own the statue, and so ultimately they would decide where the statue goes. So we would have to work with them to determine where it would go, but I think we would pursue the policy.
What do you think personally it should do? What do you think should happen to the statue, you personally?
If I had my druthers,
if you could just do it,
If I could just do it, I think moving the statue into the Lyceum, into the museum, I think that's where it belongs. I think so we can appreciate the context in our history.
This week, Alexandria City Manager Mark Jinks proposed an $800 million budget for fiscal year 2021. It includes a real estate tax increase. So tell us how you think that real estate tax increase will be received, and what does the 2021 budget carve out for Alexandria City Public Schools?
Well, that's going to be the discussion we're going to be having over the next 2.5 months. This is the first proposed real estate tax increase we've had. We basically kept the rate level in 3 years. The managers proposed that all of that 2 cents would go to capital projects, both city and schools, mostly schools. He's proposed a $530 million 10-year capital improvement program for our schools, which basically funds essentially 5 new school buildings over the next decade.
You're going to expand T.C. Williams, right?
The biggest part of that budget is a rebuild of Minnie Howard, which is our ninth grade center, which is part of the T.C. Williams High School. And that's the biggest chunk of that money. So it's certainly we have appreciations of over 4% this year, plus a 2 cent increase. That is an extensive ask of our taxpayers. And I think that'll be one of the things we're talking about over the next 2 months.
Here is Jim in Alexandria. Jim, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you, Kojo. Tom, appreciate you letting me on the air. Mr. Mayor.
Hey, Jim.
I opened up my assessment on my, tax assessment on my house Monday. You guys have hiked my assessment $128,000. You hiked it $80,000 the year before. I showed the assessment to three different real estate people that I know because I'm thinking of putting a house on the market. They said I could not even get today price for the house that it was assessed at a year and a half ago. What is going on with your assessment people? This will be the fifth time I have to fight the assessment. I'm retired from the Navy. If your goal is to force old people out of their homes, you're sure as hell going to succeed.
A 4.15 jump in average property assessments, and Jim seems to think his was assessed.
Yeah, so
more
than that. Jim, specifically, if you drop me an email, I'm happy to look into your specific situation. By state law, we're required to assess at fair market value. So that's the value that you should be assessed at. If obviously we're not going to get all of them 100% right. They're not visiting each house and looking at each individual house. They're doing a mass appraisal effort, but they look at comparable sales. And you can actually go to our website and look at the comparable sales that were used to determine your specific assessment. But please drop me a line. I'm happy to look into your specific
And if you're
situation.
Still on the line, what part of Alexandria, what neighborhood are you in?
Yeah, Tom, I'm actually not
What community?
It's just west of GW Parkway. So it's not really Old Town, though we like to think we're Old Town.
But real estate agents like to think you're Old Town.
Yeah. Okay. But it's really bad. It's out of control. And again, this is the fifth time I have to challenge it.
Yeah.
How many times have you won?
Basically, the other four times I won. let me just really quick thing. Like, I think of everything in cars because I'm a car guy. My house is like a Toyota parked in a parking lot of Rolls Royces. And that's what they got to think about. They can't just take this canvassing like the mayor said. They can't.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, please drop me a line. I'm happy to look into it.
Here's Valerie in Alexandria. Valerie, your turn.
Hello, Mr. Mayor. I actually have a wonderful in-law unit in my house now that I was exploring turning into a full-time rental unit in order to both improve my own property, but also create another housing unit in Old Town. And just came up against a pretty categorical ineligibility in the zoning law due to a slightly smaller lot size than would have allowed that as of right. This change wouldn't make any impact at all to my neighbors. It's completely invisible in the basement. And so I was just wondering if that kind of accessory dwelling unit conversation is something that we should be having around housing supply.
So, yes, absolutely, and we are having it. In fact, on Tuesday evening, we'll be talking about our planning work plan for the upcoming year, and one major component of that is what we call kind of zoning for housing. We have been having our staff look at all of our zoning rules and looking at the impact that they have on housing creation and housing affordability, and we will be looking at what changes make sense. The first thing that we will be talking about actually this year is an accessory dwelling unit ordinance to allow the kind of things you are describing. So stay tuned.
And we're almost out of time, but John in Alexandria, Virginia wants to say something that I don't know if you've been hearing a lot. John, your turn.
Hey, John.
Yes, thanks, Kojo. I just want to say that the mayor is doing a great job. We are very happy with the Seminary Road diet. I live on Seminary Road, and my kids walk to school and walk home from school every day, and this is the first time in years that we see cars going close to the speed limit because they're forced to. There's no real additional traffic delay, but the kids have now a little buffer, a bike lane between them and the cars are going slower. They're much safer. They can cross the street at the crosswalks much more safely. We use the road every day, both walking and driving, and we're very happy with it. And there are
the mayor wants to know when are your kids letters. Going to be old enough to vote.
That's obviously a crank call. You know, somebody's happy. Very quickly, Pete Buttigieg is going to be in Arlington on Sunday for a fundraiser. The other candidate, do you have a candidate yet for president?
I did. I supported Senator Harris, and unfortunately, she's not in the race anymore.
So you're not now at this point?
So I'm still trying to make up my mind. We got our primary in the third. I'm working on it.
The governor's race is next year. You and State Senator Alan Eben
Adam Edmund.
Did some for Jennifer McClellan last year. Yes. Are you supporting her for governor yet?
Yeah, absolutely. Jennifer and I go way back. She's a great leader.
We're going to get her all the time we have. Justin Wilson is the mayor of Alexandria. He's a Democrat. Thank you for joining us. Today's show was produced by Sydney Grant, and the next Kojo in Your Community conversation is just a few days away. We'll talk about changing immigration rules and their impact on local students and families. It's on February 25th at the Columbia Heights Educational Campus. Learn how to get tickets and more at kojoshow.org. Coming up Monday, black people in D.C. are 7 times more likely to be unemployed than white people, according to a new report. What's being done to get blacks in the district into jobs? Plus, James Baldwin's The Amen Corner has its world premiere in D.C. nearly 60 years ago. Now it's back at the Shakespeare Theater Company. How will it play with 21st century audiences? That all starts at Monday, at noon on Monday. Until then, you have a wonderful weekend. I'm Kojo Nam.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Julie Deppenbrock, Sydney Grannon, Lauren Marco, and Victoria Chamberlain. Our managing producer is Mana Kashvi. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Our intern is Richard Cunningham. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.